It's funny being a monk. Very good. So, okay, I apologize for being a bit late, but I thought the talk was going to start at 8:30. We'll start with some of the questions and see how we go, and see if we can do maybe a little bit of meditation just before we go to sleep tonight. Here we go. First question. Some say activating the Kundalini can help achieve awakening. Please comment. Thank you. Now, the idea of a Kundalini is something which comes out of Hindu practice. It's not part of Buddhist practice at all. It's something which arrived much later than the time of the Buddha. But nevertheless, it's a real phenomena where you get lots of energy going through your body when the mind gets very peaceful and still. See the power of this situation, Kundalini, the energy starts to move. I don't know what's going on in there. But anyhow, that in this type of meditation, though, the Buddhists recognize it as a problem, not as something which is helpful at all. And the reason is that, remember what I was saying this morning about the energy of your mind. When you're very still, you build up a large amount of energy, this beautiful mental energy. However, if you haven't done the meditation properly and it comes up when you've still got awareness of the body, that energy, instead of going into the mind, flows into your body. And it does give rise to a huge burst of energy throughout your body, but it can be very unbalanced and just cause you, yeah, you feel some energy going through, but often it's not that pleasant. So the correct way of meditating for those who go into the very deep meditations is to keep the body so still that it disappears. So that you're left with the sixth sense, which isn't a movie. The sixth sense is the mind. In Buddhism, as in original Western philosophy, always had six senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the mind is number six. Anyone who reads Aristotle would know that they had six senses. And somehow along the line, over the last 2,000 or so years, the West lost its appreciation of six senses. To the point now, the most Westerners, not most Westerners, but many Westerners, said there are only five senses, and this thing which we call the mind is just some byproduct of having a brain. Which is totally false, and I really argue against that. There is such a thing as the mind, separate from the other five senses, and to prove that for yourself is to meditate. And when you meditate, what happens if you do this meditation properly, you get very, very still. So when you close your eyes, for example, the first thing you should notice, if you were very aware, was the color of the inside of your eyelids. Now, it's dark color. You're still seeing. When you close your eyelids, you see the inside. But because that doesn't change, it doesn't alter, after a few seconds, it just turns off. It's not that you're seeing darkness anymore, you're not seeing anything at all. The sense of sight has vanished, it's turned off, it's not there anymore. Simply because when you're still and nothing moves, the brain is only wired to notice movement, the sense stops. It's the same as hearing. If there is a constant sound in the background which doesn't increase or decrease in amplitude, the sense of hearing turns off. You're just not hearing anymore. It's not that you're hearing nothing, you're not hearing. The sense of hearing is turned off because it's a stable sound. And it's the same as smell and taste. You know there is a taste of your saliva. If you don't believe me, get some of it and give it to somebody else to taste. It's really gross, isn't it? But because it's your saliva, you've got used to it, you don't notice its taste anymore. Therefore, the sense of taste vanishes. Now, the hardest, well, not one of the hardest, but one of the most difficult of the five senses to turn off is your body. the sense of feeling and sensation. And that is one of the things you experience when you meditate. You're sitting here, following the instructions, no past, no future, just being calm. Tomorrow I'll tell you about how to watch the breath, and maybe how to do some walking meditation. But eventually, in this meditation, your body starts to disappear. You just can't feel your hands anymore. Because the reason is, there's nothing going on down there when you're sitting still. So it just disappears. You can't feel your legs. You can't feel your body. You can't feel anything anymore. It's all gone. The sense of touch has vanished. To the point that someone could tap you on the shoulder and you don't notice it. Now that is the correct type of meditation, where you're being so still that the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch turn off. And that's what you're left with then as the mind, this beautiful sixth sense. Not only is this empowering you, so you do get a strong, powerful mind and all the energy just goes into that and it's not wasted on the other senses. You also get great understanding and insight of what this mind truly is. For example, it's very clear to you when you just get to that stage of the meditation that reincarnation is a fact, there's no way around that. You've been here before, you come back again. This mind does not get destroyed when the body gets destroyed. That's a very, very clear insight when the five senses disappear. You also get great amounts of joy and happiness. Immense happiness. These are the ecstasy states. When the body vanishes, wow, this is so peaceful, so lovely, so free. And lastly, you get the you get great health benefits as well. I don't know why it is, but when I just stop worrying about my body and just don't feel it anymore, a great amount of healing happens. So the energy goes where it really should be going into your mind. Now what happens with some people, yes, they're about to let go of their five senses, but they haven't quite let go yet, when energy starts to come up. When that mental energy starts to come up and you haven't fully let go of the five senses, that is when it sort of leaks into the body. I call it like a leaky bucket. It should be your mind as the bucket, it should be leaking, but it hasn't been totally released from the body. You've still got some perception of body left, which means it leaks into that, and that's when you get these energies coming up. Generally speaking, they're very unpleasant. It's not really the right place for that energy. It should be going into the mind. It's much more fun and much more power. So as a meditation teacher, I certainly do not recommend Kundalini. It just disturbs you. It misses the great opportunity for wonderful insights, great power, beautiful joy, which happens if you just totally let the body go and allow that very same energy which the Hindu tradition recognizes Kundalini, to keep that energy and keep it in the mind. That is the Buddhist way. So has anyone got any questions on that? Because that's an interesting big question. Yes?
What do you mean by unpleasant?
Unpleasant, it means unbalanced. In other words, it's huge energy, uncontrollable, and it sometimes leaves you afterwards with a sense of like a fast car, but you can't drive it. Like if I gave you, say, a Ferrari, and you know, so you can drive up and down the road to Kowloon or Phuket and back, you know, you're not trained to be able to drive such a powerful car. So you make a mess of it. You know, if you were Lewis Hamilton or Schumacher or something, fine. But that type of energy is very, very unbalancing. So you won't be able to sort of focus it. And it'll leave the whole body just feeling, again, a lack of harmony, a lack of balance inside of it. This is maybe what it feels like. And for some people, at least, with great headaches or aches and pains in the body, because simple, it's not the right place for that energy. Very good. Yes,
what type of meditation?
What type of meditation? It is like a when again you're focusing on one thing, usually to get kundalini up, focusing, bringing up sort of mental energy, but focusing it on the body rather than keeping it in the mind. So it's basically, it's unnatural. I'm saying it's unnatural, it's basically where that energy should be, it's in the wrong place. I say that as a very experienced meditator. So I wouldn't do that advice. Keep it in the mind. You get healthier, more powerful, more joy, more insight. And if you keep it in the body. Okay. When the body jerks. Okay. This is another question which happens when people get into lots of meditation. Even though this is a gentle part-time of the meditation retreat, the five precepts, there's still some people who have been meditating a long time, and even already one person asked me this privately. Sometimes in meditation when you're getting peaceful, you get either jerks or you feel yourself swaying, or you feel yourself doing weird things, like expanding or exploding or sinking into the floor or levitating. You feel you're doing that, but actually you're not. What's happening here is that you get to a certain type of meditation. Your body is very peaceful, your mind is getting strong, and what you really letting go of is what we call the conditioning or the limitations of your perception. This part of the mind which can experience the world or experience things is so brainwashed it only be able to allow certain perceptions to come into the mind. And other ones you just can't allow. But when you get to this type of meditation, all of those limitations and those barriers are taken off. And you can perceive things you're not supposed to see. To give you some idea of what happens, this is again from personal experience. Meditating a couple of times, these are the sort of, well, first of all, it was a very benign experience which I had when I was in Thailand. When I was walking past the place where the monks had their showers, the well, and I saw one of the monks had put their towel on the line to dry, and it was a black towel. And it was such a strange experience for me to see a towel which was perfectly jet black. I've never seen a black towel before. I've seen a dirty towel, but never a black towel. But I stopped and stared. It must have been for about 2 or 3 minutes at least. And just scratching my head, thinking, I've never seen a black towel. Pink towels, yellow towels, white towels, brown towels, never a black towel. And as I was wondering what was happening, still staring at that towel, being perfectly awake, actually I was very awake, just coming out of a nice meditation. The towel changed colour to white again. And it was a white towel, it always was a white towel. And my perception had seen the white towel as a black towel. Now, I wasn't going crazy at all, because these sorts of things happen to you when you meditate. You can look at a wall and the other experience, it starts to melt like chocolate on a hot day. These are weird experiences which the brain does, simply because it's playing around and it's becoming free. Becoming free from all the limitations of perception which we put on it. And that's the same which happens when sometimes you feel expanding, really expanding, filling half the room, or sinking into the floor, or swaying backwards and forwards, is a very common one. Those of you who think you're swaying backwards and forwards, you're not moving at all, you're perfectly still, but my goodness, it feels like you are. But you're not. It's just the mind playing its tricks on you. And it gets some weird stuff. When that happens, my advice to you is enjoy it. It's weird. And I love weird things. It's great. It's really cool to see the wall start to vanish or drip just like wax. It's weird to do that. It's really good fun to feel yourself expanding and expanding and expanding, becoming so huge. Because it only lasts for a few minutes, but then you get back again, so just being very, very peaceful and very powerful. Same as like even jerks. A lot of times you're not actually jerking at all. But it feels that way. This is the amazing wonder of the human mind. You ask, why do we see things the way we do? Because of the training of school and society? There's many things you just can't see. Simply because you've been conditioned not to see them. I know that I read this some many years ago, and I don't know the evidence for this, it was just a speculation, but knowing the nature of the mind, I think it could be true. Well, they claimed that the indigenous tribe which saw the ships of Columbus, of the island, I think, of Dominican Republic, that's where he landed, not in mainland America, not even Central America, but in the islands off America, they could not see those ships. Even though these were huge structures, which no one here would miss unless they were totally blind. Their eyes could see, but their brains couldn't understand what they were seeing. So they simply could not see those ships. It just couldn't exist. Therefore, even though the eyes would see them, the perception just cut them off from the brain. Or the way that they say the indigenous Inuits, or we used to call the Eskimo, can see so many different types of snow. Why only know one type of snow? They see that because their perception has been trained to see things which I will never be able to see. This idea of perception is very wonderful and magical. And when you meditate, you not only are strengthening it, but you are releasing it. To see things you've never seen before. It's great fun. Weird, you're not going crazy, you're having a really great time. So if that happens to any of you, and you start to see a little stone in the garden start to fluoresce, or start to really become huge, amazing, wonderful, enjoy it. It doesn't last that long. And you don't go crazy, you get great benefits out of it. It's literally awesome to start experiencing the power of the human mind. And that's only just the tip of the iceberg when you start to see what else you can do with this human mind. So it's a very jerk thing. Let it happen. Enjoy it. See what happens next. Great fun. That's a great experience in the monk. Especially when you, when you get into the big meditation. Here we go. It's amazing that there's some sort of synchronicity, because I just picked this piece of paper out at random, and the questions are always similar. Sometimes when I meditate, my body moves, circular front and back. I can will it to stop and it'll start again. Why does this happen? What should I do? Exactly, actually, if I took a video of you, you'd find you weren't moving at all, you're perfectly still. That's hard to believe, whoever wrote that question. But that is absolutely true. You are perfectly still. But it really feels as if you are circling around or moving. This is again what I just said. Your perception is becoming free. And you're seeing things, experiencing things which you're not supposed to experience. That's all it is. So don't will it to stop. Enjoy it. Let it be. Remember the rule of thumb in this retreat. You just let it be. Investigate it. Don't control it. And just see what happens. You're perfectly, absolutely, 110% safe. I have been teaching meditation for so many years now. Been a monk for 38 years. Amazing. I was teaching meditation for as soon as I became a monk. Even before I was a monk, I taught meditation. So I've got a long track record of teaching. And I haven't had a casualty yet. I've got 100% perfect record with my students. So which means that you are perfectly safe. So just enjoy it, see what happens. It's really good fun. See what happens next. Because you know sometimes people think meditation is boring. Especially the kids, it's boring. Nothing. It's amazing. You see, it's amazing scenes. and you're flying through the air doing psychic battles with these demons and vampires and stuff. And you've got the power. This is all happening while you're sitting here in this room doing absolutely nothing. That's really awesome. So, let it happen. Not just swaying around, that's how you begin to get to the really nice, awesome stuff. So you can do it. But actually, nothing's happening at all. It's just the mind is creating these images. And you're playing with them and having great fun. During meditation, I'll notice that my breathing becomes heavier and then becomes lighter subsequently. Is that normal and am I going in the right direction? Everything is normal. Again, it's been such a long time since I've read a question which I haven't read before. As I've read that so many times from other people. Yes, sometimes your breathing gets heavier, sometimes it gets lighter. Your job is just to let it happen. Your body knows how to breathe. How many times during your day, when you're at work, when you're at home, do you pay any attention to your breathing? And still your breathing has done its job successfully, otherwise you'd be dead, you wouldn't be here. So your body knows how to breathe, it's been very successful all these years doing the breathing. So don't interfere with the breathing, let the body do it, it's the expert. So that's why, if I am going in Singapore Airlines or Silk Air anywhere, I don't go up to the pilot and tell him how to fly the plane. I haven't got a clue how to fly the plane. Same with you, you haven't got a clue how to breathe. Your body does that for you. You try and get involved and you can make it into more trouble. So just let the body do the breathing. If you want to breathe in heavy, you can breathe in heavy body. If you want to breathe in light, you can breathe in light. Sometimes you stop breathing altogether. And then you say, I'm going to die, I've got to breathe. No, if the body doesn't want to breathe, let it not breathe. If it wants to breathe, it will breathe when it's ready. So just let it go, leave the body alone. It knows what to do much better than you do. That's what it's like sometimes for some people there, if the press stops for a little while. Don't get afraid. The body needs some more air, it will breathe in. Your job is just to be this passenger, the passive observer who just watches and does absolutely nothing. So that's why I'm your breath sometimes stops. Any questions? Has ever Ajahn Brahm ever seen a ghost or an angel? I am now looking at about, how many is it, 150 angels? You're all angelic members of the Buddhist Fellowship. Angels have come all the way from Slovakia and Austria and New Zealand and Sri Lanka and Thailand. So you're all angels. And if you really want to see some angels, go to Bangkok. It's Koh Tao. The city of angels, isn't it? Or Los Angeles? The angels. The angels or ghosts. And if you want to see a ghost, do you want to see a ghost? What are you looking at now? A Kuai Lou. So that it really is a real ghost of a real angel. And even though this has got absolutely nothing to do with meditation, still, people love ghost stories and angel stories. So, for those of you who didn't hear this ghost story, this only happened last October. I did tell a few of you, you know, about this ghost story, but this is a very recent personal ghost story from October 2011. This was still during our annual Rains retreat over in Australia when I received an emergency call. This lady, she was from Sri Lanka begged me, I know it's on retreat, but could you please give some time to my brother who's dying. He had some very bad form of cancer, and the family moved him to Singapore, for the Singapore General Hospital, I think it was, to get really good treatment. But even in Singapore, they couldn't stop the progress of his disease. He was dying. And his sister said that she'd given him some of my tapes. He could not even read at this point. He was paralyzed from the neck down because of the illness. But he was listening to some of my talks on CD, liked them, and she asked me, can I speak to him? So of course, even though it's retreat time, I'm not supposed to do anything. Of course, there are rules, but the basic rule for a monk, number one, is be kind. Compassion rules. I said, yeah, sure, okay. So for two evenings in a row, I spent maybe half an hour talking to this man in his bedside. He tried to talk back, but he was so weak that, you know, you had to wait as he was speaking and listen really carefully because he had a hard time enunciating any words. So I did most of the talking and advice, telling him what death is like and what's going to happen to him and how to deal with it. And he gave, I managed to call him on the second evening as well. On the third evening he died. So I wanted to be able to speak to him just beforehand and give him some really good advice. On the fourth evening, I never realized he died that third evening. It was only the fourth evening when his sister called me to give me the news he died the night before. But then she also said, a strange thing happened early that morning. About 12 hours after he passed away, she received an email from him. An email from beyond the grave, simply saying thank you. Especially thank you for arranging the talk for that young man. That's why she wanted to pass that on to me. And this was 12 hours or so after he had died. There was no way he could have set that up beforehand, because he was paralyzed for days before he died. But an email from beyond the grave. 12 hours after he died, he sent the message. I told this joke before. It is true. I always wondered, not being all that well versed in high tech, I always wondered what Gmail meant. Now I know it means first mail. That's really true. Amazing story. So, if someone close to you dies, please check your email afterwards. You never know what you might try. But sometimes ghosts can do some really strange things. But the angels, they're much harder to see than ghosts. Because a lot of times the angels, they have having a really good time. You know, they don't really sort of come around much for human beings. But yes, sometimes they do exist. But they're hard to find. And usually you don't see them. If you do see them, sometimes you don't notice them. They appear as human beings. There could be one sitting next to you right now. And you would not know. But of course the angels only would come down if there was something to do. And the classic story, this was again from a friend of mine, who will still remain anonymous because, you know, he says he doesn't mind spreading the story, but he doesn't want people to know who he is. And that's the story of the American monk who is working for the Peace Corps in Thailand. This is not just Jamaica, it's also American working for the Peace Corps, another monk in Thailand. Who, after 2 years of doing Peace Corps work in this country, decided he wanted to become a monk. just for the experience, but he did not know how to become a monk. He was staying in a hotel to the north of Bangkok at the time. So he asked the concierge. Now the concierge knows the bars, and knows if he wants to get a girl somewhere, but didn't really have all that much of a clue on how to become a monk. But at least he did know there was one monastery in the center of Bangkok called Wat Pho Wong, in which many Western monks had ordained. And so he told this young American, go to Wat Pho Wong in the middle of Bangkok. Take some food, and when the monks come out early in the morning, put some food in the monk's bowl, and then ask them, I want to become a monk. He said, that's how it should be done. That's totally wrong, but nevertheless, that's what he did. So he went early in the morning, too early, the monks hadn't come out for alms round here. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. You don't come out until dawn, or just after dawn. So there he was, walking up and down this deserted street. All the gates were locked, no monks around, wondering what to do next. When a Thai man approached him, and this Thai man spoke perfect English and asked him what he was doing, then he said that he wanted to become a monk, and this is what he'd been told. This Thai man told him, the gates are not going to be open for a couple of hours. But nevertheless, I've got a key, I will let you in and show you around. So this Thai man opened the gates, and they went in together. And the Thai man opened the door of the main hall, the main meditation hall, and it was also the main ceremonial hall, where ordinations happened. And this was a very old temple, built a couple of hundred years ago. And as this man entered, he turned on the lights, and gave this young American a guided tour around this temple. And of course you all know in the Thai temples, as well as the Sri Lankan ones as well, they have these paintings on the wall. And many of those paintings are the old stories from the Buddhist text known as the Jatakas. But the way in Thailand they paint just one picture, but that picture you've got to follow it like a cartoon, to find out the sequence of events. You know, there is a chronological order. What happens first, then what happens second, what happens third, what happens fourth. And you've got to follow it around to find out the sequence of the story. And this Thai man knew the whole sequence and was an amazing amount of information about the stories. But he also knew why these paintings appeared, who sponsored them, and why. Maybe because of the death of a child, or because a father passed away, and they did that as merit for their family. And time flew by, and by the time they got to the last mural, the man, the Thai man, said, look, the monks are going to come out in another 5 minutes. You go out the gate, I'll turn off the lights and lock up. Look out for this old monk, he's the abbot or the secretary or something. Put food in his bowl and ask him and he will help you. And that's what this monk did. While the lay person turned off the lights and locked up. And, just as he predicted, this old monk came out, put food in the bowl. Monk said, wait for me till I come back and I'll take you inside. So he took him inside the temple and started learning all of the chants and all the processes needed for becoming a monk. But remember, this was maybe 30 years ago. So the monk they gave him to teach him the chanting could not pronounce English very well. So much so that this American was getting more and more confused. So he asked him, he said, look, is there not someone else who can speak English better? Because, I'm finding it hard to understand what I'm supposed to be doing. And the monk said, you know, I've got the best English in the whole monastery here. And that's where the American said, well, what about that temple boy, the attendant who let me in? And that's the first time he told what happened that early in that morning. And the monk said, what temple boy? The one who had the keys for the gate and opened up and let me have a look inside. And at that, the monk took him straight to the abbot's office and told him to relate the story to the abbot. The abbot only heard half of it before he stopped him, called the secretary, and asked him to begin again to take this all down. Because there is no layperson who has the keys to that gate or to the hall. That particular gate, as maybe Diri Yupa from Bangkok knows, that's the King's Gate in Wat Bawang. Even I know that. Only royalty are allowed through that gate. Wat Bawang is a temple where the kings of Thailand are ordained, and royalty as well. It's a royal temple. Only they enter through that gate where they do some sort of ceremony or ordination or do a continuous ceremony there. That's the only people allowed in. And only the abbot, maybe the secretary, has the key. And only they have the key to the hall. And actually, you can't turn the lights on there where he's supposed to turn them on. And not even the old abbot knew all the stories of those paintings. So the abbot, when he finished the story, asked him, what did that man look like? And like many Westerners would say, he'd only just been in Thailand a short time. He said they all look the same. How do I know? Dark hair. But what was he dressing? He said, actually the dress was really strange because it was old fashioned dress. But what did he look like? And this is actually true. This was what the monk said. He said he was just trying to find words to describe what this Thai man looked like. But he was, you know what you do when you're thinking, you look around. And that's when he froze. He saw the painting on the wall of that man. So it's him. He was the guy. Who is he? That was King Rama the Fifth. An old king of Thailand. That's why he could go through that gate. He was royalty. And he knew about those paintings because he was there at the time when they were commissioned. And that was a true story of a Thai king. Died maybe 150 years ago, who helped a Western man become a monk. Open doors which cannot be opened. Turn on electricity where it cannot be turned on. And relate stories which everyone had forgotten a long time ago. And that's the true story that I know the people involved. That's an angel story which sends shivers down your spine. That will only happen. It will only happen if you're doing something good. If you've lost the keys to the house and want someone to open it up for you, no one. If you want to become a monk or a man, yeah, they can open up doors for you. That is a truly angel story. Interesting one. Just like at the time of the Buddha, when angels opened the door for Yasa, who went off to become a monk. Really interesting, but that's absolutely true. Your angel stories, yes.
Famous Thai writer, and she claims that some devas, you know, like in the Hindu devas, the Shiva and the Narayana, came down and teach people, but well, they just got separated, but they just come and maybe get it by a person, and the person who becomes that deva and teach.
Oh, no, yeah, no, that's...
Can it be true?
That's, she was asking about when people get possessed.
Yeah,
and so when people get possessed and they start talking in strange words, and strange tones of voice. And sometimes we call that these are wise people teaching us. Now, a lot of the times, if they were really wise people, they would not be invading other people's bodies. That, for me, is the sign this is not a wise person, but a lower being. So I never trust anybody who invades another person's body and takes over. These are pretty much low beings not to be trusted. What I really like is a story from the sutras, where one of the devas came to appear to the Buddha. This was in the Indopala cave. It was the god they called Saka, which was the same as Indra in Hinduism. And as soon as this god appeared before the Buddha said, basically, "Hi, how are you going? What can I do for you?" And at that, the god said, "At last! At last! I've met somebody who I can ask my questions of." He said, "I've appeared to so many other meditators and hermits, and as soon as I've appeared, they've asked questions of me! So I never get a chance to ask my questions. Just because I'm a deva doesn't mean I know the truth. I know what I'm doing." So that's when Saka asked his questions of the Buddha. Because the Buddha never got excited when he saw a supernatural being. Just because it's supernatural does not mean he's correct. This is a story I love telling. You may have to edit this off the tape afterwards, actually.
I will.
For a moment, but I can't resist this. You made jokes about my bottom earning today, so I don't see why. Oh, yesterday. So anyway, this person got into a very good meditation and started hearing the sound of a supernatural being. First of all, they thought they were imagining it, but it was real. And the being said, "I can help you. Go to the casino." And now, first, if you were just writing, just imagination, they said it very clearly, "Now come on, I can help you. Go to the casino." So she went to the casino. And she heard the spirit say again to her, "Go to the roulette wheel." So she went to the roulette wheel. And the spirit said again, "Put $100 on number 17. Very clearly. Now that was a supernatural being. And you're Singaporean, you probably do that. So she put $100 on number 22. And this creepier, whatever they call it, puts the ball, spins the wheel, and went round and round. What did that little ball fall? Number 22. It won. And the being said, "Put all the winnings on number 17. All the winnings on number 17. So she put all the chips on number 17. So put the ball in the wheel, span it round, went all the way around, fell into number 17 again. She was making a fortune. Put all the winnings on number 9. She heard the spirit say, "Very good, number 9. And she put all on number 9, put the ball in the roulette wheel, and they spun it around, went round and round, and that ball fell into number 9, but bounced out into the number next to it. And she heard the spirit say very, very clearly, "Oh shit." The evil spirits can make mistakes. So don't believe it, for goodness sake. So you can take that out afterwards if you really want to. But I don't know if you can, because that's what you say when things go wrong. That's even what spirits say as well when things go wrong. The moral of that story is that don't believe it just because people get possessed.
She claims that the devil that possessed her friend was a Shiva, you know, the king of the gods, and he also taught her the Dharma, and he said that the deva said that he's an anapani. That's why he's able to teach Dharma.
Okay, so if people claim to be anagamis or arahats, have you ever met monks who claim this and claim that? You've met monks who other people claim to be this and claim to be that. Some are, some aren't. So, don't just trust the teachings because of what a person says they are, what their attainment is. Instead, trust the teachings if they make sense and they lead to peace and freedom. So it doesn't really matter. You're not justifying the teachings because of the teacher. You justify the teachings. They're good, they're believable, they should be followed. Just whether they're good teachings or not, independent of where they come from. Otherwise, when you give authority to the teacher instead of the teachings, that's where there's a lot of problems come. That's what we call guru worship. You have a guru, and your guru says, do this and do that. This happened in England, I was told. In the monastery in Amarwati, they had such a strong hierarchy there, you just did what you were told. When one of the nuns told her driver, go straight ahead of the roundabout, the driver did just that. Never went round, but went straight over the roundabout. That's not what I meant by going straight ahead. But sometimes people can be so stupid, whatever their teacher says, they follow it 100% to the letter, rather than understanding what their teacher really meant. Especially those of you who've got too much faith in Ajahn Brahm. Whatever I say, oh, it must be right. So when I say that fish and chips is the most important food in the whole world, that's a joke, for goodness sake. Don't say, oh, Ajahn Brahm eats fish and chips, so I must eat fish and chips. We must all eat fish and chips. We must all drink tea, otherwise we'll never get enlightened. Have coffee and noodles, whatever you want. But that's the trouble with gurus. Sometimes we listen to the guru rather than listen to the teachings. So be careful there. It doesn't matter what the teachings are, whether they come from a supernatural being, from a monk, from a nun, or just from an ordinary person who thinks it's a nobody. If they're a good teaching, follow them. Now I don't know if you know this story, but this was one of the stories from basic Buddhism which really inspired me. And I tried to follow. You know the second monk in the time of the Buddha, the one who was the wisest next to the Buddha himself, was a monk called Sariputta. And in this story, Sariputta was going on alms round, walking into the village. And this little novice monk, maybe about 12, 13 years of age, said to Sariputta, he said, you're badly dressed. Your lower robe is not on properly. Now remember, Sariputta was this powerful monk, enlightened, so wise. Now, number two in the hierarchy of Buddhism, next to the Buddha. And what did Sariputta say? You're right. There is something wrong with my robe. So he immediately went behind the bush, adjusted his robe, came out, and then put his hand up and said, thank you, teacher, to this little novice. And that's a part of Buddhism which we don't talk about enough. You put me up here, I'm high. But if you tell me something, I think, oh, good, you're right, thank you so much. I would say, thank you, Ajahn Dhiraj. Could you take that as a title? Difficult, but if you're a Buddhist, you can very easily. Because this is actually a marvelous thing. The hierarchy, the Dhamma, the teachings, the truth, is higher than any monk or nun or teacher. So please, don't worship the teachers. Worship the teachings. What the Buddha said in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta before he died. When people asked him, once you die, who's going to take over? Who's going to lead Buddhism Once you passed away, and you know what the Buddha said? The Dhamma and the Vinaya, the teachings, they will be your leader once I've gone. Now that was an amazing thing which the Buddha said. It stopped all this idea of having popes and Sangharajas and Mahanayakas in Sri Lanka and bosses and popes and cardinals. The teacher is not Ajahn Brahm, it's the Dhamma. It's not Saka, the king of the gods, or Anagami, it's Dhamma Vinaya. Let that be your teacher. Otherwise you will be struggled by having too many gurus. One of my latest books, which was translated by the Indonesians, is called Kangaroo Guru. Very bad paragraph. So if you want a guru, go to Australia and get a kangaroo. They're the only gurus I like. Kangaroos. I went to other Thai meditations. I got back pain and leg pain, so I cannot meditate. Thai monkey said you have to be patient, tolerate the pain. The pain will be gone, you become enlightened. What is your opinion on this teaching? Well, the main type of meditation, which I'm going to teach tomorrow, is the breath meditation. That's the way the Buddha become enlightened. You know what the breath meditation is called in Pali? Anapanasati. Many people know that, because it's the most popular type of meditation, Anapanasati. Ana means along with, prana, the breath, sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness along with the breath. And I am cracked a joke, the Buddha taught Anapanasati, he never taught Anapanasati. Mindfulness along with the pain, he never did that at all. So please don't do Anapanasati, which is what he's suggesting here. We got back pain and leg pain, so I cannot meditate. What happens if monks or nuns or lay teachers start doing that sort of teaching? It will turn people off meditation. You won't want to come to a meditation retreat ever again. And you will tell your friends that meditation will have this terrible reputation, it's just torture. And who would want to meditate? Who would want to spend the, few days, which are very hard to get in your busy lives, just enjoy back pain or leg pain? In fact, if you do that these days and get people to endure pain, you're likely to get into big trouble with Amnesty International and the International Court of Human Rights, because that is the method used in Guantanamo Bay, prolonged stress position, used to torture people. That's a torture process. Sit in what's it actually called? Prolonged stress positions. It's a way of torture used by the US military to gain information against potential or suspected terrorists. And to think that Buddhism does the same thing is a scandal. The Buddha is compassionate and kind. If the Buddha was here and you had a bad back, what would the Buddha say? Will he say, enjoy? Say, no, just lie down or sit on a chair, you poor thing. That's what a Buddha would say. And it's true, you don't get enlightened through enduring pain. That is what the Buddha tried to do for 6 years before he became a Buddha. Enduring pain for 6 years, fasting, sitting, enduring this pain and that pain. And the first thing he did after he became enlightened, said, don't do that. That's called Paticcamatthana Yoga. One of the extremes, he said, use the middle way. The way of pain is one of the two extremes. So don't do that. Otherwise you'll just get into more problems. One of my friends, he's an abbot of one of the monasteries in England. Ajahn Munindo, you read about him. That's what he did. He decided to sit through the pain in his knees. I was there at the time. We had to send him to hospital afterwards to get a double knee reconstruction. Like absolutely dummy stuff. If you want to be a dummy, fine, just go and enjoy the pain. If you want to be enlightened, move. just basic common sense. So, and that is what works. Look at the timer. Who teaches that? Does he move? God bet your life he does. So that is what you do. Not patience, not tolerance, use common sense and wisdom. So look, basically if you're meditating, and maybe you're getting peaceful, but you've got an ache in your leg, what you should do, what I do, so I'm getting older and stiffer, I don't open my eyes, very slowly and lightly, I move my leg around. That took about 20 seconds. I lost a bit of my stillness, but now I've got no pain. And soon, maybe another 20, 30 seconds, I go back to where I was before I started moving. And from there I can go much deeper. That's how I practice. It's much better than trying to endure. If you endure, the pain gets worse and worse and worse. You never get into still, peaceful meditation. But also you get an aversion to meditation. It doesn't work. Some good questions tonight, but I better hurry up because there's a heaps more. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. With legs and things like that, you can adjust. But what if every time you try to meditate, you have
headache? Okay. Yeah, the headache type of meditation, the first time I experienced that, I've never had headaches when I've been meditating. All the time I started meditating, because I was taught in a very good way to begin with. The first time I encountered that was when I went to Malaysia, and people started calling it Samadhi headache. And I thought, what on earth have you guys been doing? Because that's nothing to do with Buddhism at all. What it means is you're putting far too much effort into your meditation. You're not putting the cup down. You are holding it, let's not get it still, you're trying. Many people in Singapore and Malaysia, you have to work so hard. You've been so highly motivated to get where you are in your career that you just find it so difficult just to put things down. When you want to achieve something, you do it. And that attitude might work in life, it does not work in meditation. It's a sign if you get headaches you are trying far too hard. Let go for goodness sake. Relax. And you don't get any headaches at all. In the sutras, the Buddha said, this is a path without groaning. A very beautiful translation. If you're groaning, it means it's not the path. If it's a headache and pain, you've lost the path. It should be very, very peaceful, relaxed and open. If you start off with a headache, fair enough, you can have a headache but during the meditation. But with still, you can let it go and it can disappear during the meditation. But if you start with no headache and somehow or other a headache comes during your meditation, something wrong with your meditation. Try too hard, struggling. I haven't told this teaching yet here, but this is the basic teaching of meditation, again. One of those easy to remember teachings which will probably change the whole direction of your meditative career. The two types of meditation. And don't think the two types of meditation are samatha vipassana. That's not what I mean. The two types of meditation are second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. Using the well-known formula of the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. And what's the second noble truth? Craving causes suffering. So if you're in meditation, you have suffering. You've got headache, or backache, or frustration. It means you have been doing second noble truth meditation. You've been craving. Even craving for good things like peaceful meditation or being able to watch your breath, even if you've been craving for good things, that is still craving and it causes suffering. The third noble truth, letting go of craving, leads to the peace, the happiness of nibbana. But if your meditation is getting peaceful, if you have this beautiful sense of peace, contentment, the body is at ease, the mind is relaxed, you have just been doing third noble truth meditation. You've let go of craving, well done. So those of you who want to know what actually is letting go of craving, it's that which produces the peaceful meditation. So if you're very peaceful, you're having a really good meditation, you've just been doing some letting go. That is what we mean by letting go. That is third noble truth meditation. But if you're getting tightness in the head or the body, or you're getting frustrated, you think, I can't meditate, this meditation is not working. If you're suffering, that means you've just done second noble truth meditation. You've been wanting something. That's a very, very good understanding of what the two types of meditation are. Letting go, putting things down, everything is peaceful, body is relaxed, mind is free. You want something, you get tense, you get headaches, you get frustrated, and you think, I can't meditate. Everybody can meditate, it's just some people just don't do it the right way. And they do second noble truth meditation rather than third noble truth. People understand that because that just changes the whole idea of meditation. And many people who never meditated before now get it. I'll get on a bit because I've only got about 4 or 5 questions and there's about 20 to go. But anyway, when it gets too late, what's the time now? 9:30. Shall we have a tea break? Bring me in the toilet break? So? Sounds good. Okay. So remember, we're now going to do some letting go.